This is edition number 1992 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 7th of November, 2025. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today, we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 6th of November, 2025. My name is Kate Harris, and my fellow readers are
Caroline Allen,
Hannah Stiff,
and Chris Allen.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 7:10 and will set at about 4:10.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes a cathedral librarian, frost in the garden, gorillas and a little poetry.
But we begin with the main news items, which include a crash between a skip lorry and a motorcyclist, a speed fiend caught doing 100 miles an hour, a corpse mix-up and a vicious battle over a mountain bike trail. Let's start with these lead stories.
The driver of a skip lorry has admitted causing a crash that left a motorcyclist with injuries from which he may never recover. Michael Frank, 60, turned his DAF truck into the path of the oncoming biker on the B1145 near Aylsham. Norwich Magistrates Court heard his actions had been a momentary lapse of concentration with catastrophic consequences. The rider of the Suzuki SV650, a man in his 50s, suffered multiple fractures to his legs, 8 ribs, ankle and vertebra in the crash on July the 11th. The court was told he had been left with nowhere to go to avoid the collision as the lorry pulled across the road to make a right turn. The injuries have had an enormous impact on the life of the rider, who had previously completed training with the Norfolk Advanced Motorcyclists. Prosecutors said his victim impact statement submitted to the court was harrowing, and he faced a long and hard road to a full recovery. Frank, of Baxter Row in Dereham, pleaded guilty to causing serious injury by careless or inconsiderate driving. The court was told he had been employed to drive skip lorries 6 months prior to the crash. At the time of the collision, he had been on a trip between Aylsham and Causton. James Burrows, mitigating, said, "He is aghast at what happened and the consequences which he has to live with in terms of knowing the impact on the victim." He said he had attempted to assist the biker at the scene and had fully admitted his actions had caused the crash. Magistrates sentenced him to a 12-month community order with requirement to complete 200 hours unpaid work and pay costs totalling £199. He was also banned from driving for 12 months. Following the crash, the Causton Road was closed for 4 hours while emergency services and an air ambulance attended the scene.
A high-octane car enthusiast has been jailed for a horrific crash after filming himself driving at more than 100 miles per hour on multiple occasions. Rhys Reddle G, 26, has been driving at high speed without his headlights on when he flipped his Ford Focus ST in the early hours on February the 6th. His passenger, a woman in her 20s, was left with life-changing injuries after suffering a broken spine and deep lacerations to her head in the crash on the Northern Distributor Road at Rackheath. Norwich Crown Court heard she had pleaded with him to stop and turn the lights on. In the moment before the crash, Reddle G turned to his passenger and apologised before letting go of the steering wheel. A statement read aloud in court detailed how the collision had impacted the passenger's life. She said, I had no idea he would be so reckless. I trusted someone I clearly should not have because this has devastated my life. Red Algie of Ostend Place in Walcott pleaded guilty to causing serious injuries by dangerous driving. Edward Renvoir, prosecuting, said he was a dedicated car enthusiast who regularly attended car park meetups and took photographs of modified motors. Earlier in the evening, he had taken part in illegal races, cutting up other drivers and doing wheel spins. Following the collision, analysis of his phone found multiple videos of him driving at speeds of up to 150 miles per hour. Snapchat message from a friend 2 days before the crash warned him about his driving and referred to a previous collision in December 2024 when he had lost control at more than 100 miles per hour. The garage tyre fitter, who appeared in court on crutches after suffering an open leg break in the crash, was jailed for 3 years and banned from driving for 3.5 years. Andrew Oliver, mitigating, said he was prone to showing off and bragging, which showed a level of immaturity. But sentencing him, Judge Alice Robinson said, "You were simply reckless rather than being immature." She added, "Evidence from your phone shows this was far from being an isolated incident." Speaking after the sentencing, PC Liam Nickling of the Roads and Armed Policing Team said, "Having attended many collisions as a Roads police officer, I was shocked that this did not have fatal consequences. Multiple wooden stakes struck the vehicle and the passenger headrest. Red Algie and his passenger are both lucky to be alive. If he continues to drive like this in the future, he will kill someone, whether that be himself or another."
Bosses at Norfolk's biggest hospital have apologised after staff released the wrong body from its mortuary. The corpse was collected from the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital by undertakers who thought it belonged to someone else and took it to a funeral parlour in North Walsham. It remained there for 4 days before hospital staff realised the blunder and the body was returned to the hospital mortuary before being collected by the correct funeral directors in Norwich. The family of the body, which was wrongly removed, have been informed. The hospital has blamed human error for the mistake, which is understood to have arisen because the mortuary held the bodies of two people with the same surname. The unfortunate incident, which took place earlier this month, has raised questions not only for the hospital, but for the funeral parlour, Mural Cork, which did not detect that it had collected the wrong body. Dr. Bernard Brett, the Norfolk and Norwich's medical director, said, "We have offered our sincere condolences and unreserved apology after a deceased patient was mistakenly transferred from our mortuary to the incorrect funeral directors. Despite many process checks being in place, a combination of human error and failure to follow all our standard operating procedures led to this very regrettable incident taking place. As soon as this error was identified, the deceased patient was returned to the trust and arrangements are underway with the funeral director. The trust has confirmed that an investigation is underway and ongoing, and the family confirmed to this newspaper that they were cooperating with the hospital to make sure such an episode could not happen again." A family statement said, "We are working closely with the Norfolk and Norwich and are still grieving. We ask for our privacy to be respected." No other details are known about the deceased, but it was also confirmed that the body was released ahead of Norfolk's coroner giving permission to do so. Dr. Brett added, "We have met with the family to apologise sincerely for this mistake, to discuss what happened and our actions following this isolated incident. We have already identified additional steps, many of which have been put in place, including more rigorous checks before transferring patients to funeral directors, an upgrade of mortuary IT systems and improved ID check processes. From funeral directors to avoid a repeat of this very regrettable incident. Muriel Cork was also approached for comment but did not respond. Last week it posted a statement online which referenced funeral standards being highlighted in the media. It said, "We wanted to provide reassurance about our services and to talk about something incredibly important to us, trust and standards. When you place your trust in us, you deserve the absolute assurance about how your loved one will be cared for. Unfortunately, not every funeral director operates to the same standards, and this is why inspection and accountability matters. Your loved one deserves the dignity of an inspected and accredited funeral provider, and this profession owes you the highest possible standards of care and nothing less." It added, "It was a proud member of the National Association of Funeral Directors and fully adhered to its code of practice.
It has become a vicious battle over a mountain bike trail that makes up slightly more than 2% of Bacton Woods' some 280 acres. Sparks have been flying between dog walkers and bikers over the land in the woodland near North Walsham for some time. Bikers say they should be allowed to use the area due to a lack of designated trails and have criticised dog walkers for leaving mess. But the pet owners claim the bikers are damaging the beauty spot by digging out pits to make jumps and obstacles, as well as rushing past at dangerous speeds. The row has seen dog walkers use their own shovels to hit back against the bikers by knocking down their jumps. Now rangers from Forestry England have officially forced an end to the feud by using their own shovels to flatten the unauthorised jumps once and for all. And the organisation says it cannot support the pleas of the mountain bikers to transform the area into an official mountain bike trail at Bacton Wood is remotely managed. Sammy Chandler, whose son enjoys spending time in the park, recently rallied together a group of 10 bikers to help make the forest safer. The boys, aged between 12 and 16, spent the weekend filling holes, flattening jumps, and moving logs off the trail to help meet Forestry England's safety standards. Mrs. Chandler's father, Mike Chandler, also crunched numbers to determine what percentage of the sprawling wood the mountain bikers' area actually takes up. According to Mr. Chandler, the area frequented by mountain bikers takes up 2.2% of more than 280-acre beauty spot. Speaking about the clean-up effort, Mrs. Chandler said, "There were no dangerous jumps built. If anything, there were some that were quite large that we evened off and made smaller. We imagined that if a three-year-old was on a little balance bike and wanted to ride around, what would we do to make the whole thing completely safe? It took us all day. The kids got stuck in. So, if anything, we almost completed that day with Forestry England completely in mind." She also claims that dog walkers who have nothing better to do were lurking behind trees and watching from afar while the clean-up effort took place. "I almost wanted to go over, but I didn't want to have an argument," Mrs. Chandler said. "I simply wanted to make it a safe place for kids and everyone to enjoy. It's almost so cowardly of the dog walkers. If they'd come over, I would have said we're not digging any more jumps. We're making it less fun for the kids, if anything." Not even 24 hours later, shovel-wielding dog walkers travelled to the woods under the cover of darkness to destroy jumps that bikers had worked hard to make safe earlier in the day. Mrs. Chandler said they pulled logs out and chucked them everywhere. A spokesman from Forestry England confirmed rangers travelled to the site soon after and officially removed the jumps and filled in the pits, forcing an end to the so-called Battle of Bacton Wood. Mrs. Chandler sent an email to Forestry England outlining her issues with the removal of jumps and to campaign for the creation of a designated biking area. But in its reply to her, the organisation stressed that Bacton Wood is managed by remote workers based more than 55 miles away at its headquarters in Sandon Downham near Brandon. It explained that this was one of the main reasons why the jumps were removed. The email states that Forestry England does not have a regular staff presence at Bacton Wood, nor the time or resources to adequately manage the unauthorised cycle features that have been built there. This includes dealing with any health and safety issues that may potentially arise. Keeping the jumps in place would mean rangers routinely travelling 55.5 miles from Suffolk to check if they were safe. It added, if site resources change considerably, then perhaps a discussion regarding the creation of a more officially mountain bike trail could be had.
A drunk driver caught behind the wheel almost six times over the limit has been arrested after failing to appear at court. Oliver Briggs, 43, was stopped driving a Toyota Yaris on Stony Lane in Reefham on April the 9th this year. A breath test later discovered the proportion of alcohol in his breath was 186 micrograms. The legal limit is 35. Briggs, of Whitwell Road in Reefham, pleaded guilty at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court to drink driving and having no insurance. However, he subsequently failed to comply with the preparation of a pre-sentence report or attend a court hearing on August 11th. Appearing at Norwich Magistrates Court in custody after being arrested on a warrant, he claimed to have not received court correspondence in the post and to have been unable to get to Yarmouth. The court heard he had a previous drink-driving conviction. He was given bail with a condition to attend a probation appointment ahead of being sentenced on December the 2nd. He has been banned from driving under an interim disqualification.
A discount supermarket chain is upgrading its stores across Norfolk to make bargain hunting even easier. German retail giant Aldi has announced it will roll out new dedicated reduction zones. These areas will be full of discounted bread, fresh produce and other perishable items nearing their use-by date. It means customers will not have to check multiple sections to find items that have had their prices slashed. The move is part of the chain's commitment to making high-quality food as affordable as possible while reducing waste. Luke Emery, National Sustainability Director at Aldi UK, said, "Our customers already know they can rely on us to provide unbeatable value, but our new reduction areas will make it even easier to pick up a last-minute bargain. By creating dedicated reduction zones in store, we're helping point shoppers towards quality food at cheaper prices, all while cutting down on food waste." In Norfolk, Aldi has stores in Norwich, Dereham, Thetford, Fakenham, Diss and King's Lynn.
A young receptionist from North Norfolk died after taking over-the-counter painkillers, a court has heard. Jessica Reynolds, who was known as Jess, passed away at Addenbrookes Hospital, Cambridge, on July the 25th this year. An inquest opened into the death of the 23-year-old of Sandy Lane, Buxton, near Aylsham, at Norfolk Coroner's Court this week. It heard that her primary cause of death was multi-organ failure as a result of hepatic neurosis due to paracetamol toxicity. Area coroner for Norfolk, Yvonne Blake, requested statements from Miss Reynolds' GP, Norfolk and Norwich Hospital, Addenbrookes Hospital, Norfolk and Suffolk Foundation Trust and substance abuse charity Change Grow Live. Her family have been invited to submit a pen portrait to the court, as well as a statement outlining any concerns they may have. Miss Reynolds was born on December the 31st, 2001, in Norwich, and is believed to be a former pupil of Aylsham High School and a City College Norwich student. A full inquest to determine the official cause of death will take place on February the 12th next year.
A warning has been issued after a woman became trapped up to her thighs in quicksand in a North Norfolk beach. The incident happened in Walcott Beach on Monday, October the 27th, when a woman walking towards Haysborough came into difficulty in a patch of sinking sand near the groins. It is understood she was submerged up to her thighs before managing to pull herself out of danger and shout for help. North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, did not receive a report of the incident, but a spokesman has urged people to stay away from the groins. While we have no reports of anyone in difficulty on Walcott Beach, NNDC would like to remind everyone that when enjoying North Norfolk's beautiful beaches, it's always safest to stay away from groins and rock defences, he said. Patches of sinking sand can develop in those spots without warning. Last October, Munsley Parish Council issued a warning following reports of quicksand on the village's beach. The patch was in front of the public toilets where a groin had been removed for coastal works.
Our next few news stories include a shoe protest, concern over the loss of farmland, some angry footballers, and the problem of noisy jets.
Parents left shoes on the steps of Norfolk County Council's headquarters to symbolise children with special educational needs and disabilities, SEND, who, they say, have been let down. The shoes left at County Hall through the Every Pair Tells a Story campaign were to represent children who have missed education or whose needs have been ignored, misunderstood or dismissed. Norfolk has some of the highest numbers of children with an Education, Health and Care Plan, EHCP, legal documents which outline the special measures youngsters should get to support their education, such as one-to-one teaching, extra therapy and equipment. But families say some youngsters are waiting beyond the 20-week legal time frame to get the plans issued. Amy Bradley, founder of the SEND Sanctuary UK, which organised events at councils across the country, said, "No child should be left behind because the system decided their needs were too complex or too inconvenient. This is about every child failed by broken promises and endless red tape. The government must listen to parents. We are not the problem." The SEND system is costing Norfolk County Council huge sums of money, with a £183 million deficit forecast. But the government has delayed publication of a white paper on reforming SEND until 2026, to the frustration of families and politicians. The council says the proportion of EHCPs issued within the statutory timeframe is between 58% and 61%, above the national average, but agreed that reform is needed. Penny Carpenter, Cabinet Member for Children's Services at Norfolk County Council, said, "The shoes laid out in Norfolk and at locations across the country show that families feel the SEND system isn't working and they want change. We agree that government SEND reform is urgently needed. Here in Norfolk, we're investing in a wide-ranging programme to strengthen support and early help in mainstream schools to make sure every child can flourish in their education. We're increasing the number of places in specialist provision, and just over a year ago, we set up a support line for parents and professionals to make it easier for them to speak to us when they need advice and guidance." Green MP Adrian Ramsey, who represents Waveney Valley, attended Monday's protest. He said, "Seeing those empty shoes lined up was infuriating, because each one represents a child who has been failed by a system that should protect and support them."
Building homes and solar farms on farmland could lead to the UK's food production dropping by almost a third, according to a study by a parliamentary group chaired by a Norfolk MP. Mid-Norfolk MP George Freeman warned, "Agriculture is at a tipping point due to government targets for housing, infrastructure and renewable energy, which could see up to a quarter of farmland disappear over the next 25 years. A study for the cross-party, all-party parliamentary group on science and technology in agriculture, which Mr. Freeman chairs, found that without urgent reforms to farming and land use policies to enhance yields, domestic food production could decline by 32% by 2050. Norfolk has recently seen a spat of applications for solar farms on agricultural land, including the 4,000-acre Highgrove solar farm stretching from Dereham to Castle Acre, and the 2,700-acre East Pye scheme near Long Stratton. The Labour government says such projects are crucial for its net zero drive and the reduction of dependency on fossil fuels, while it has also pledged to build 1.5 million homes. But Conservative Mr. Freeman said, "In July, the government's food strategy rightly set out the goal of creating a healthier, more affordable, sustainable and resilient food system. But those ambitions risk being undermined by competing priorities from other government departments, particularly the growing push for industrialised solar farms on agricultural land and associated infrastructure. We simply cannot afford to lose prime farmland to meet renewable energy targets. Without radical policy reform, the UK risks further erosion of its food self-sufficiency and growing reliance on imports at a time when geopolitical instability and climate extremes threaten global food supply chains." The report was launched at a summit in Westminster on Monday, with more than 100 cross-party politicians, scientists and industry stakeholders attending. A spokeswoman for the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, said farming had a central role in kick-starting economic growth and the government recognised the importance of food security. They said the government was already trying to better integrate cross-government working on food production, infrastructure and housing through a new land use framework. DEFRA said the total area of land to be used for solar projects was very small, and even the most ambitious scenario would only occupy up to 0.4% of total UK land. And the department said developers should focus on brownfield, industrial, contaminated or previously developed land before agricultural land.
Norwich City head coach Liam Manning has slammed unacceptable behaviour from fans alleged to have intimidated players' families. Many supporters made their anger clear after a 2-0 loss to Hull at Carrow Road on Saturday. Hundreds gathered outside the director's entrance, chanting against Manning, sporting director Ben Napper and executive director Zoe Webber. A large group were also pictured outside the South Stand, where players leave the stadium after home games, and were reported to have blocked players and staff members' cars into the club's car park. Chaplain John Norman also claimed that he'd seen players' wives and children verbally abused outside the ground, and that's where Manning says he draws the line, despite accepting fans' right to protest. "I had no issues in terms of getting out, to be honest," he said. "I believe that some did. We have to be careful. Everyone's got the right to protest, and I understand why people are protesting, why people aren't happy. I'm one of those. I'm not happy. I'm frustrated. All of the emotions that fans will be feeling, I will as well. Probably even more so, because it's my day-to-day life. I live it 24/7. For me, where it becomes too far is when players' families feel threatened or uncomfortable. It then goes from professional to personal for me. In any walk of life, if you're at your job, you shouldn't feel threatened when you're going to work. I think it's unique to football. There probably aren't too many industries where it happens. The 40-year-old was keen to make clear his understanding of the feeling from fans amid a run of 6 straight defeats. Although he didn't witness protests firsthand, he called on them to avoid violence and abuse. I think there's a real fine line, continued Manning. Of course, I want to reiterate that people have the right to protest. But at the same point, there's a level where it becomes violent and abusive. That's not acceptable. When people feel threatened, that's not right for me.
An MP has called for the training patterns of fighter jets over North Norfolk to be reviewed, saying the noise is making it hard for people to work. Liberal Democrat MP Stefan Akron has faced a backlash for his parliamentary plea, with critics saying such flights are critical for the defence of the country. During defence questions in the House of Commons on Monday, November 3rd, the North Norfolk MP said he had been contacted by dozens of constituents frustrated at the noise from RAF and USAF fighter jets. He said, "It makes it hard to work, it traumatises pets, and in the case of one of my constituents, it has left them with permanent hearing damage. They and I recognise the importance of training, but carrying out continuous manoeuvres over populated areas when we are so near to the North Sea baffles them. Can the Minister assure me that he will review the training patterns in our area and take steps to reduce the impact on my residents?" Al Carnes, Defence Minister, said, "The UK and its allies must be ready to deal with the most demanding of circumstances, deterring and preventing a full-scale war by being combat-ready. Low-flying training plays an indispensable role in achieving and maintaining our war-fighting capability, and that is spread throughout the whole of the UK to help minimise disturbance to the public. Those increased training missions are to support an increased deployment across Europe, but I will meet the Minister to talk through these issues and see if we can make some slight changes." Mr. Akron's call sparked a backlash on social media. Felicity Bullen said, "I feel this may be the opinion of a sparse few. I don't mind hearing them at all and knowing that they are training for what I can only assume is inevitable at this stage. Makes me feel glad they are there." Alan Parcell said, "I have lived in North Norfolk for 15 years and love to see the military aircraft. Absolutely no complaints from me." Trudy Smith said, "The only people complaining are the people that have moved to the country. Most of us have grown up with these RAF bases around us and are so used to the noise that we don't notice it much anymore." However, Mr. Akron said, "Those flights are rattling windows, disturbing daily life and spoiling the peace of our beautiful coastline and countryside. There's no reason many of these exercises can't take place over the North Sea, where they'd have far less impact on our communities. I am calling on the Ministry of Defence to show some respect for local people and move those training operations offshore." In 2021, Duncan Baker, Mr. Akron's predecessor as North Norfolk MP, also raised the issue in the Commons, saying he had been inundated with concerns from residents.
A coastal pub's plans for a new sign have stoked fears that the area's dark skies over Saltmarsh could be affected by light pollution. The Dun Cow in Salthouse applied to install an illuminated sign outside the venue in Purdy Street, but this was met with concern from villagers. Dr. Victoria Holliday, a Conservative councillor for the area, said the pub would have to be careful in how it was lit up, so it does not have an overly adverse effect on the area's dark skies or highway safety. Another villager said, "Salthouse is a conservation area and has a dark skies policy. There are no street lights or lit commercial signs in the village. This protects the special qualities of the area." Following the scheme first emerging, Punch Pub Company, which owns the venue, appears to have had a rethink following the backlash. The firm has since submitted a revised application in which the sign is no longer illuminated. A decision on the sign will be made at a later date. The application comes as the pub has also applied to create an outdoor bar area.
An award-winning Michelin star restaurant and hotel on the North Norfolk coast has been sold after being on the market for more than a year. Mawston Hall, near Blakeney, has been transformed by its owners Gorton and Tracy Blackerstone over the last 30 years. But now, after more than three decades of owning the venue, the hotel has been sold. When I first opened Mawston Hall in 1992, it was simply a house with potential, Mrs. Blackerstone said. Over the years, with hard work, passion and the support of an incredible team, it grew into one of the country's most celebrated hotels, renowned for its Michelin-starred food and warm Norfolk hospitality. Letting go of Mawston Hall is bittersweet. It holds decades of memories, friendships and unforgettable moments. Tracy and Gorton Blackerstone, who own the hotel and restaurant, also help run the number one Cromer fish and chip shop alongside Spencer Gray. The country house currently contains 13 boutique guest rooms and a renowned restaurant, which has maintained its Michelin star for an unbroken period of more than 25 years. Mrs. Blackerstone claims her attention will now be on number one, Cromer, and creating experiences at the popular venue. It remains unclear who has purchased the pub.
An East Ender star has visited a butcher's in Cromer. Ross Kemp, who played Grant Mitchell in the BBC soap, went shopping for local produce in Beast to Block on Tuesday. The 61-year-old spent most of his childhood in Norfolk and regularly visits the county. He was in Norfolk this week for his father's funeral. In a Facebook post on Tuesday, Kemp said, "Burying my dad tomorrow, my hero, my role model and a great dancer." During his visit to North Norfolk, he took a great interest in Beast to Block and told staff that his grandfather used to be a butcher. Alex Pendleton, who runs the business, said it was a surreal moment when he saw the actor and television presenter. "He is really nice, a friendly man, and he took the time to introduce himself to the staff," he said. "He came in to buy a lamb cutlet, a pork chop, a beef tallow and two Norfolk red wines. It was a great compliment as he checked out our butchers online beforehand and chose to visit us."
A quintessential village pub is changing hands after almost 3 years. Couple Kent Laws and Julie Heakin took over running the Cricketers on the Green in Aldborough in 2023. Since then, they have gone from strength to strength, even scooping their first AA Rosette for culinary excellence in March 2025. But the pair have now revealed, with heavy but very proud hearts, that they are handing over the keys. In a statement shared to the Cricketers on the Green's Facebook page, Mr. Laws wrote, "Both Julie and I are honoured to have played a part in its history and are very proud of our quintessentially multi-award-winning pub and restaurant. That could not have been achieved without an outstanding team, and we have one of the best. One of that team will now take on the responsibility, and we are delighted that, having already been such a large part of the pub's history, Julie Bacon will become the next landlady from Saturday, November the 1st. The pair extended their thanks to everyone who has visited the pub. You will still see us in the village, we're not going far, and hopefully for a drink on the right side of the bar, they added.
You are listening to edition number 1992 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 7th of November 2025. Still to come, there are items about new-style postboxes and cake sheds, and, of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that...
There are no letters or obituaries in the newspaper this week, but here are some local events.
On Saturday the 8th of November, from 7:30pm, a concert will take place by critically acclaimed pianist Ilya Kondratiev. Tickets range from £7 to £15. The event will be held at St Botolph's Church, North Walsham Road, Trunch. Contact 01692 402 624 for details. On Sunday the 9th of November from 10:30am, a group walk will take place starting at Ludham Village Hall, Broadreaches, Ludham. Also on Sunday, from 10am to 4pm, the Norfolk and Norwich Horticultural Society will hold its Late Autumn Horticultural Show at St Faith's Centre, Manor Road, Horsham St Faith. Admission is free. Contact 01362 821 549 for details. And on Wednesday the 12th of November at 7:30pm, a talk entitled Bringing Back the Beaver by the South Yare Wildlife Group will take place at the Poringland Community Centre, Overton Way, NR14 7WB. Non-members, £5.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we make our monthly visit to Book Corner, discover that frost is a gardener's friend, explore guerrilla friendships, and hear some wartime poetry.
In this month's Book Corner, we meet the woman who cares for Norfolk's little treasure trove in Norwich Cathedral. This article, written by Emma Lee, was published in the Norfolk Magazine on the 16th of July 2022. Since 2003, Dr. Gudrun Warren has been librarian and curator of the library at Norwich Cathedral and has more than 30,000 books in her care. I was a great reader when I was young. I always had a book on the go, says Dr. Warren. Being surrounded by them is such a joy, and this sort of historic collection I find particularly inspiring, because there's something about the whole structure of the books and the history. Some of the books tell you stories about the people that have owned them in the past. There's been a collection of books on the site since the cathedral and monastery were founded in 1096. Around the cloister, you can see the remains of cupboards where some of the books were originally kept. Gradually, people started bringing their books together in a room that became known as the book room, the library room. We know that there was something like that in Norwich by the latter part of the 15th century, Dr. Warren explains. The oldest printed book in the historic collection dates back to 1474, The Divine Institutes by Lactantius, a 4th century author. The movable type printing press was invented in about 1450, so this really is quite an early one, says Dr. Warren. One of the most interesting books is A Book of Common Prayer, which was published in 1845. Although it's a printed book, it is decorated almost as if it's an illuminated manuscript, says Dr. Warren. To me, the decoration shows how somebody who's producing the book wants it to be something that you would treasure. In addition to theological texts, the Cathedral Library is also home to a large collection of important local books, including a three-volume first edition of the Paston Letters, a collection of correspondence between the prominent Norfolk family, which gives a glimpse into life during the Wars of the Roses and the early Tudor period. It is the tantalising details hidden within the pages, such as handwritten dedications and annotations to the texts, that bring the past to life. One example Dr. Warren gives is of a 17th century book which has been owned by a whole series of well-known local families. Anna Gurney and Sarah Buxton were cousins. Anna has given the book to Sarah, and they have given it later to their friend Elizabeth Wilson, who married into the Upchurch family of Sheringham Park fame. It then goes down the Upchurch generations, she says. So, in one page we've got at least three important Norfolk families represented and an understanding of how they interacted with each other. They're handing on a book and building up its history in doing so. If somebody came into a library today and started marking the books, I would get very angry with them. But when you open a book that's several hundred years old and see people's marking in it, then it's actually telling you something about how the book was used and who used it. Of course, to preserve the important collection for future generations, conservation is an important part of Dr. Warren's work. She keeps a close watch for any environmental changes which could affect the delicate pages, and, with the help of the cathedral's volunteers, she is in the middle of a long-term cleaning project. The shelf gets cleaned with a mixture of methylated spirit and water, and then the books get cleaned. The dust, which can provide food for insects, is brushed off them, explains Dr. Warren. It also means that we can check the books to see what condition they're in. If we find any problems, then I get a professional conservator to have a look. We started about 5 years ago now, and we're just over halfway through, so it's a long, slow job, and the kind of thing that when we get to the end, we could just start again.
In our next article from the Garden Answers newsletter of the 6th of October 2025, we look at why frost is the gardener's friend. Opening the curtains on a chilly November morning and witnessing the garden laying frozen under a crisp white blanket of frost is a magical moment. But as autumn turns to winter, many gardeners become anxious about the risk of frost damage to plants instead of marvelling at one of nature's beautiful spectaculars. In fact, frost isn't just a winter wonder. It can actually be good for the garden. And as long as you've taken care to protect tender plants, a cold snap can do the power of good. Experienced veg growers take frost in their stride, safe in the knowledge it'll work wonders at boosting the sweetness and enriching the flavour of crops, such as parsnips, Brussels sprouts and kale. As the temperature drops, plants release enzymes to protect themselves from freezing. They do this by digesting some of the starches in their cells, turning them into sugars. Dissolved in the liquid inside cells, this sugary solution rises the freezing point of their tissues, preventing them from rupturing as the ice inside their rigid walls expands. This makes crops tastier, sweeter, and the higher sugar level can balance out more sharp, fiery or bitter flavours. Clay soils may be water retentive and rich in nutrients, but they can be heavy to cultivate. That's why autumn digging and leaving clogs exposed to frost has traditionally been recommended to improve soil structure. Clay soil particles tend to bind together to form large plate-like aggregates. This obstructs the movement of water, air and nutrients in the soil and makes it more difficult for roots to penetrate. The tradition is to leave clay soil bare to weather over winter. During this period, water enters into cracks and then, when it freezes, it expands and breaks apart the aggregates into smaller, more manageable, crumb-like structures. As we often have mild, wet winters, the tradition of leaving clay over winter can't be relied on. So try growing a green manure over winter to improve soil structure. Field beans work well on heavy clay soils. Many gardeners swear that harsh frosts can eradicate overwintering pests. But does the science back up this theory? Certainly numbers of slugs drop in periods of prolonged cold weather. They will try going deep into the soil to escape, and some will survive. But it's a fact that in deeply cold climates, slugs are much less of a problem for gardeners than they are here. We have to be careful what we wish for, though. A hard frost will also kill beneficial insects, which play an important role in keeping pests in check. In the orchard, fruit growers often panic about frost, but once trees have shed their leaves, a cold snap will work wonders. Fruit trees must experience a period when the temperature is between 2 and 12 degrees Celsius, with 7 degrees Celsius being optimal, before they come into leaf and flower in spring. It's when trees have open blossom that late spring frosts pose a risk, damaging flowers and lowering yields as a result. Even though gardeners should not fear frost, there are some wise precautions to take. Before freezing temperatures set in, store away garden equipment and protect taps and outdoor furniture from the worst of the winter weather. Insulate outdoor taps by wrapping them with some bubble wrap held in place with an elastic band. Wind up hose pipes and store them in a shed or garage. The plastic fixings can be damaged by cold temperatures. Clean the barbecue and garden furniture with a stiff brush and let them dry before moving them under cover. If you don't have a space to store them in, invest in furniture covers to protect them from rain and snow. Then sit back and wait for those spectacular frosty mornings.
Next, we hear from Victoria Gill, science correspondent at the BBC, as she explores friendships among gorillas. This article was published on the 6th of October 2025 on the BBC News website. The relationships built up between female mountain gorillas are more important than previously understood, new research suggests. It shows that when one of these social great apes moves into a new group, she will seek out and join another female she already knows. Scientists base the research on 20 years of data covering multiple groups of gorillas in Volcanoes National Park in Rwanda. The scientists found that even when two females have been apart for many years, a newly arrived gorilla would still try to join a female she had formed a previous connection with. The findings, published in the Royal Society Journal, show how important the relationship between two individual females is in gorilla society. Scientifically, I don't know if I can talk about friendship, explained lead researcher Victoire Martignac, a PhD researcher from the University of Zurich. But we're showing here that same-sex relationships really matter. Moving into different groups is key in shaping the animal's social structure. It's something that both males and females do. Females will sometimes move several times throughout their lives. This dispersal, as it's known, plays a role in avoiding inbreeding, spreading gene diversity, and shaping social relationships. In the wild, it is very important, explained Ms. Martignac, but extremely hard to study because once individuals leave a group, it's hard to keep track of them. working in partnership with Deanne Fossey, Gorilla Fund, at a field site that has been monitored since 1967. Ms. Martignac and her colleagues were able to track these movements. Poring through decades of information on the animals' lives, the scientists followed the dispersals of 56 female mountain gorillas, examining which new group they choose to join and why. The gorillas avoided groups that had males they were likely to be related to, but the presence of females they knew also mattered a lot, Ms. Martignac explained. The females would often gravitate to a group with females they had grown up with, even if that was many years ago. They also sought out individuals with whom they had made a social connection, perhaps having played and interacted with recently. Ms. Martignac explained that the gorillas would invest in these relationships because they deliver key social benefits. New arrivals usually start at the bottom of the social hierarchy, she said. Resident females can be pretty aggressive towards them because they're potentially a competitor. Moving around is something that is also crucial in shaping human society. And the researchers say that studying its roots in other great apes can shed light on the evolutionary driving forces behind it. Movement is a huge part of the way we live, said Ms. Martignac. But those decisions do not fossilise, so we look at them in our closest cousins. She added that this new insight into gorillas' social lives reframes how we think of female-to-female social relationships. They're much more important to these animals than we used to think.
For our final magazine item, with the 11th day of the 11th month almost upon us, we include a selection of poems to honour those who have fallen. Poetry is a central part of Remembrance Day, with many verses capturing the sombre reflection and profound loss of conflict. The most well-known poems, including works by soldiers and civilian poets, focus on themes of sacrifice, memory, and the harsh realities of war. Let's start with one famous example, written by a Canadian military doctor following the death of a friend during the Second Battle of Ypres. It references the poppies that grow on the battle-scarred fields of Belgium. In Flanders Fields, by Lieutenant Colonel John McCraw, May 1915. In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. This next poem was written by an American professor and humanitarian and was intended to be a response to In Flanders Fields. It plays a significant role in establishing the poppy as a symbol of remembrance. We Shall Keep the Faith, by Moina Michael, November 1918. O you who sleep in Flanders fields, sleep sweet to rise anew. We caught the torch you threw, and holding high we keep the faith with all who died. We cherish, too, the poppy red that grows on fields where valour led. It seems to signal to the skies that blood of heroes never dies, but lends to lustre to the red of the flower that blooms above the dead in Flanders fields. And now the torch and poppy red we wear in honour of our dead. Fear not that ye have died for naught. We'll teach the lesson that you wrought in Flanders fields. Our last selection is an enduring poem often recited during Remembrance Day services. Its fourth verse, known as the Ode of Remembrance, is particularly well known. For the Fallen, by Lawrence Binion, September 1914. With proud thanksgiving, a mother for her children, England mourns for her dead across the sea. Flesh of her flesh they were, spirit of her spirit, fallen in the cause of the free. Solemn the drums trill, death august and royal, sing sorrow up into immortal spheres. There is music in the midst of desolation, and a glory that shines upon our tears. They went with songs to the battle, they were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end against odds uncounted. They fell with their faces to the foe. They shall grow not old as we are left grown old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. They mingle not with their laughing comrades again. They sit no more at familiar tables of home. They have no lot in our labour of the day time. They sleep beyond England's foam. But where our desires are and our hopes profound, felt as a wellspring that is hidden from sight, to the innermost heart of our own land they are known, as the stars are known to the night. As the stars that shall be bright when we are dust, moving in marches upon the heavenly plain, as the stars that are starry in the time of our darkness, to the end, they remain.
Those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include threats to our precious waterways, parcels in postboxes, a new TV drama set in Norfolk, and a nostalgic look at 1970s childhood.
A row over new planning rules that critics say could leave Norfolk's rare chalk streams at risk has taken a fresh twist after an intervention by the Bishop of Norwich. The House of Lords has supported Bishop Graham Usher's calls for new legal protections for the precious waterways as part of the forthcoming Planning and Infrastructure Bill. It follows government ministers dismissing calls from a cross-party group of MPs for stringent rules to be put in place to ensure the streams are protected from harm caused by new developments. Backed by 196 votes to 137 against, the amendment requires development plans to list chalk streams and identify how they will be protected. It also imposes a responsibility on planning authorities to protect and enhance chalk stream environments. Without the amendment, the proposed new legislation would not require planning authorities to take particular account of chalk streams in their decision-making. A separate proposal to limit over-abstraction would also come too late for many of the threatened waterways. Bishop Graham called for a planning system that works with nature, not against it. However, whilst the amendment was passed in the House of Lords, it still needs to gain the backing of MPs. Environmental campaigners have urged people to contact their local MP in a bid to gain their support for the changes. Mark Dye, spokesman for the Gaywood River Revival, which has been fighting to protect the West Norfolk chalk stream, said, "We are thankful that the House of Lords has backed the protection of chalk streams like the Gaywood River, which are already threatened by over-abstraction and pollution. The government seems to have forgotten that these fragile ecosystems are not only habitats for rare and cherished species, such as brown trout, kingfishers and white-clawed crayfish, but also vital for the future of our drinking water. I hope that MPs recognise the tremendous support for this in the Lords and now uphold the amendment they have voted through." Dubbed England's rainforests, there are only about 200 chalk streams left in the world, with 85% of them found in the UK, 25 of which flow through Norfolk.
New postboxes of the future are to be rolled out across Norfolk in the coming months, marking a landmark change to the classic design. The new version of the Red Royal Mail postbox will allow customers to send and return parcels up to the size of a shoebox. A solar-powered barcode scanner will open a drop-down drawer to place parcels that would not fit through the traditional postbox slot, which will remain in place. It marks the biggest change to postboxes in 175 years. A spokesman for Royal Mail said, "Our new postboxes of the future offer another convenient way for customers in Norfolk, Lowestoft and elsewhere to access Royal Mail services alongside home delivery and collection, our customer service points, post office branches, lockers and Royal Mail shop outlets." Jack Clarkson, Managing Director of Out of Home and Commercial Excellence at Royal Mail, added, "We are all sending and returning more parcels than ever before. This trend will only continue as online shopping shows no signs of slowing, particularly with the boom of second-hand marketplaces. Our message is clear. If you have a Royal Mail label on your parcel and it fits, put it in a postbox and we will do the rest." The new smart features of the postbox of the future mark the biggest change to the classic design since the 1850s. The first red postboxes in mainland Britain were erected in 1853. But a change was made in 1859, which standardised the colour of all postboxes as green. Complaints were received by people having difficulty finding these green, inconspicuous postboxes. A return to the more striking red was specified in 1874. It took 10 years to complete the programme of repainting.
The BBC has revealed the cast of a new drama that is being set and filmed in North Norfolk. But When We Dance is a touching story about two people who have a lot in common, including Parkinson's. Emmy and Golden Globe award-winning Laura Linney and BAFTA award-winning Rhys Ivans will star in the title roles. Ivans plays the role of Tony Evans, the deputy head of a local primary school, while Linney portrays Emma Dredzin, a pianist, composer and single mother of two daughters. The characters do not know each other until an encounter changes the course of their lives, when, on the same morning, they are both diagnosed with Parkinson's. Director John Madden said, "I'm really looking forward to telling the story of Tony and Emma, a friendship which unfolds unexpectedly. A story of humour and emotion, of challenge and bravado, of music and dance, transcending the assumptions of a little understood condition and triumphing over the odds to find joy, release and love." Monica Dolan from Mr. Bates vs. The Post Office and Black Mirror and Rory Kinnear also star in the 90-minute film. Writer Paul Mayhew Archer, who was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2011 at the age of 58, added, "It's incurable and it makes many of the things I do, walking, talking, smiling, increasingly difficult. But though I have reasons to hate Parkinson's, it has also brought me opportunities I wouldn't have missed for the world. The latest of these is the chance to work with the brilliant director John Madden and wonderful actors on bringing this story to life. Parkinson's UK estimates that someone is diagnosed with Parkinson's every 20 minutes in the UK.
A nostalgic look back at the mischief and memories of 1970s childhood is coming to the stage. Stumpy Sanderson's 1970s Jamboree Bag is set to be performed at Sheringham Little Theatre on Friday, November the 28th. The show, created by North Walsham storyteller Andrew Bramer, blends stories and songs about a spiky-haired boy and his gang growing up in the 1970s. Mr. Bramer said, "The show follows the outrageous and extraordinary japes, scrapes and capers of a group of working-class boys growing up in the 1970s like I did. Audiences love it, saying it not only made them laugh, but brought back brilliant memories." Mr. Bramer is a businessman, award-winning public speaker and guitarist who tours with his tales from the decade of flared trousers, Findus crispy pancakes, Sunday afternoon wrestling and punk rock. The show is filled with references to 1970s life, from Vesta curries and Bar 6 chocolate to cheesecloth shirts, platform shoes and TV favourites like On the Buses and Magpie. It also recalls the era home decor trends, including wood chip wallpaper, brown and orange paint, polystyrene ceiling tiles and a veneer of nicotine yellow. Mr. Bramer, commercial director at PSS in North Walsham, is also a distinguished Toastmaster and named UK and Ireland Humorous Speech Champion in 2000. He now performs as Stumpy Sanderson in live theatre, on podcasts and in a weekly show on Poppyland Radio. The stories are said to be drawn from two 1970s time capsules buried in beer cans, including a classic Watney's Red Barrel Party 7. Mr. Bramer said the tales include run-ins with Stumpy's long-standing rivals, the Doc Martin-wearing Milton sisters, Mandy and Melanie, who back in 1974 crushed his and Stumpy's clackers in a school woodwork vice. Tickets start from £10.50 and are available from www.sheringhamlittletheatre.com or by calling the box office on 01263 822 347.
Monsley Lifeboat has called for charities to benefit from this year's Boxing Day dip. The annual festive tradition sees participants take a chilly sea swim to raise money for local causes. This year, the event will take place at 10:30 a.m. on December the 26th. The event brings together spectators, swimmers and splashers, all contributing to generating essential funds for community charities. Monsley Lifeboat is now inviting charities to express their interest in being one of the beneficiaries of this winter's event. Sue Shaw, interim chairperson of the Friends at Monsley Lifeboat, said, "Monsley's Boxing Day dip is a brilliant way to bring people together, raise awareness and generate vital funds for those making a difference in our community. We're proud to support the incredible work of local charities, and this is one way that we're able to help. Charities must submit their applications by November the 17th to secretary@monsleylifeboat.co.uk, detailing how the funds raised would be utilised. successful applicants will also need to have representatives present on the day to help with bucket collections.
A new drama club for children has launched. The club, based in Bardersfield, is for 9 to 12-year-olds. It began on Wednesday, October the 15th, and will run weekly until Wednesday, December the 17th, at the Battle of Britain Memorial Hall in Lammas Road. Sessions, which cost £5 per person per session, will run from 6pm to 7:15pm and will include drama games and scene rehearsals. Participants will be able to join the club at any point during the 10-week run. Organiser Ben Wilmot said, "It's going to be a fun, relaxed drama club where people can join in with some drama games, explore their creativity and discover more about the theatre. No previous experience of taking part in a drama club is needed. Everyone is welcome to come along and get creative." Bardersfield is a 10-minute drive from both Aylsham and North Walsham and 5 minutes from Coltishall. Anyone interested in joining the club, which is supported by the Broadland District Council, should contact Ben Wilmot at ben@benwilmot.org or call 07780 758 586.
It will soon be looking a lot like Christmas in one Norfolk town as plans for a festive weekend are revealed. Festive Holt will return to the market town from November the 15th to the 17th with 3 days of free live music acts, children's entertainment, activities and food and drink. Several events will run on each day throughout the town. On November the 15th, numerous businesses will remain open until 8pm for some late night shopping. Carol singers will perform in Lee's Yard from 1pm and the Sheringham Shantymen will take over Shire Hall Plain between 6:30pm and 8:30pm. A town-wide Christmas Jumper Day will take place on November the 16th and further festive events will run on the Sunday. Deep-fried Christmas pudding, mulled cider and hot chocolate will be served at Eric's Pizza in Fish Hill. When the Holt Christmas lights were cancelled in 2024, a committee made up of locals and business owners came together to bring the festive cheer to the people of Holt. There will be no road closures and no fireworks, and the lights will be turned on at dusk.
The Hornsey 3 Community Benefit Fund has granted more than £250,000 to support 14 Norfolk projects. The largest share of £72,000 has been awarded to the Pandora Project, a charity aiding women and children affected by domestic abuse. The funding will allow new drop-in services in King's Lynn and Wells, helping women access immediate support and advice. A spokeswoman said, "This funding will allow us to reach more women in crisis, offering them a safe, accessible first step to get help. We are incredibly grateful to Orsted and its Hornsey 3 Community Benefit Fund for making this possible." Great Yarmouth and Galston Young Carers, the Burnham's Surgery Community Healthcare Trust, Holt Youth Project and YMCA Norfolk are also among the beneficiaries. Other recipients include Baconsthorpe Parochial Church Council, Reflex Theatre, West Norfolk Befriending, Napton Village Hall Management Committee, Mulbarton Parish Council, Weybourne Parish Council, Magic Acorns, Headway Norfolk and Waveney Limited, and Norfolk Community Law Service. The next application deadline for the fund is November the 26th, 2025. Details can be found at grantscape.org.uk.
Our last few articles cover the restoration of a Cold War radar, a rugby-loving care home resident, another Thursford spectacular and a shed full of cakes.
A towering Cold War radar dish is turning heads once more as it undergoes its first professional restoration in over 30 years. The 100-foot T-84 radar antenna at RAF Nita's Head is being brought back to life with its original army green and eggshell blue colours re-emerging, along with RAF squadron markings and engineering stamps. The restoration is part of preparations for the site's upcoming public bunker opening and Searching for Home exhibition, which launches on Thursday, November the 14th. William Sashiti, owner of the RAF Nita's Head bunker, said, "You can actually see people doing double takes as they drive past. We've cleared one section and it's brilliant army green and eggshell blue underneath. People had forgotten what it originally looked like. It's like discovering a hidden monument." The T-84 radar played a vital role in defending Norfolk's skies during the Cold War, and the restoration project has been underway for nearly 3 years. Work includes high-pressure washing, specialist metalwork treatment, and hand cleaning of delicate components. A team of computer modellers also created a digital replica to plan the restoration and identify materials. Mr. Sashiti said, "Some parts are cleaned with special chemicals that remove grease or grime, while other parts need a more abrasive technique, like sandblasting, to strip away rust safely." He has even managed to reactivate parts of the radar system, with plans to demonstrate the antenna during the Remembrance exhibition. Project curator Anya Vero said, "We're literally peeling back layers of history. Each section we clean reveals another chapter." By Remembrance Weekend, visitors will see this magnificent machine as the RAF operators saw it, a pristine, powerful symbol of defence and dedication. The restoration is being privately funded by Mr. Sashiti. "This radar protected Norfolk," he said. "Now Norfolk shall see it in its full glory." To register interest in the Searching for Home exhibition, visit academyofrobotics.co.uk/remembrance.
A rugby-loving care home resident has enjoyed a day out watching her favourite sport. Overbury House resident Cynthia enjoyed an unforgettable day out when she attended a local under-18 Colts rugby match between Holt Rugby Club and North Walsham. She had been personally invited by one of the care home's team members and players, Max. Max, who works as a kitchen assistant at Wroxham-based Overbury House and plays for Holt Rugby Club, had been chatting with Cynthia about rugby when he discovered she was a passionate fan of the sport and a follower of England star Ben Youngs. Delighted by their shared interest, Max asked Cynthia if she would like to attend one of his matches, an invitation she warmly accepted. She joined supporters on the sidelines to watch the exciting game, which saw Holt triumphant over North Walsham 25-21. Max delivered an outstanding performance and was named player of the match. Cynthia was thrilled by the close-fought contest and enjoyed every moment of her day, complete with a bacon roll and enthusiastic cheers from the crowd. "It was such a wonderful day," said Cynthia. "I loved every minute of it." Overbury House is part of Healthcare Homes, which operates care services across the south and east of England. Healthcare Homes said the Wroxham site is known for its welcoming atmosphere. Beautiful period building with large bay windows and landscape gardens, featuring mature trees, shrubs and a beach-themed area. They added, "With a vibrant activities programme, the team at Overbury House strives to ensure residents feel valued, engaged and part of the wider community.
The first images have been shared of the UK's biggest Christmas show as the cast prepares to delight audiences this festive season. This year's Thursford Christmas Spectacular will take to the stage for the first time on Saturday. Fresh off the back of winning Best Christmas Experiences for the second consecutive year at the Group Leisure and Travel Awards, the team promises that it will be the most magical year yet. The Thursford Christmas Spectacular has been entertaining millions of people for 48 years, with its West End quality production filled with singing, dancing, music and comedy. The three-hour show continuously welcomes more than 50 coaches a day, with around 110,000 people travelling from across the UK to watch the performance. More than 120 singers, dancers, musicians and speciality acts will perform across a 130-foot stage, accompanied by a 32-piece live orchestra. In recent years, the show has had some major upgrades, with 2023 seeing a state-of-the-art sound system being installed. This year will see the biggest investment in costumes to date and all new routines, including a second showgirls act not seen in the show before. George Cushing, associate producer, said, "We never rest on our laurels, and this year's show is no exception. It is set to be our most magical year yet. Not only do we have two fantastic showgirl routines, we've also invested heavily in all new costumes. The whole production of this year's show is exciting, and we can't wait to show our audiences what we've been working on. Don't wait to book your tickets, as they're selling out fast. The Thursford Christmas Spectacular is on sale now and runs from Saturday to December the 23rd with matinee and evening performances."
Sheds are typically used to store gardening tools or keep unwanted items out of sight. But people across Norfolk are now swapping their lawnmowers for loaded brownies, all in the name of selling sweet treats. Self-serve cake sheds are seeing a surge in popularity as more open up across the country. Kat Clayton from Pawlingland is one of the entrepreneurs who has been caught by the cake shed buzz. She started her business, Clayton's Cake Shed, from her home in Howe Lane early this year. "I wanted to turn my love of baking into more than just a hobby," the mother of one said. "I thought an honesty box would be perfect, as I can stock it up and it basically runs itself. That way I can carry on with other work and look after my toddler." Each week she is busy creating sweet treats for Shed, which is open Saturdays and Sundays between 10 a.m. and 7 p.m. "I bake around 200 cakes, and fortunately they sell out most weekends," Mrs. Clayton said. "My best sellers are definitely the cookie pies. They are always the first to go." Another sweet spot in Norfolk is the Sweet Treat Shed, which has locations in Shipdham and Great Ellingham. The sheds are another self-serve cake business, stocked by a small home bakery named Ab Fab's Sweet Treats. It is run by Abigail Gamble, who opens her home bakery and trailer business in September 2023. Due to the demand, she decided to open a cake shed on her drive in Great Ellingham alongside a shed outside of her friend's home in Shipdham. "I opened a sweet treat shed at my home in Great Ellingham last year and it was really successful, so we added Shipdham too," Mrs. Gamble said. "I've always loved baking since I was little, so being able to do it full-time from home is amazing. Being a home baker, I don't have a shop front, so it's my way of selling my bakes locally." The Shipdham Sweet Treat Shed in Pound Green Lane and the Sweet Treat Shed in Orchard Green, Great Ellingham, are open from Friday to Sunday between 10 a.m. and 7 p.m.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send out new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson. Editing and producing was Chris and Lorna Wilson. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!